2 cans of beer per man. The men were amazed. It had never occurred to them that there would be beer on board, certainly not cases of it. But there it was, and these men would much rather drink than quote regulations to the old man. They were moving. They were breathing. The batteries were charging. They were embarrassed, even bloodied. But at that moment they didn't care. They were safely away, and for the first time the men admitted to one another that they had never been certain they would escape. The Soviets had obviously been capable of sinking the sub. They just didn't want to. Or maybe, the crew mused, they did want to, but weren't allowed. There was no official celebration for Gudgeon's return back at Yokosuka when she pulled in that Monday, August 26th, 8 years to the day since Kuchino had sunk. The mood at the base was grim. The Soviets announced that day that they had conducted their first successful flight test of a land-based intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM. In such a tense climate, the Navy wanted the Gudgeon incident squashed, and squashed fast. Badass, the radio tech who had sent the message in English, was promoted to chief and transferred off the boat instantly. Word was the sub-force made him send messages from then on with his left hand, lest his style, his signature of sorts, tell anyone intercepting communications that a U.S. sub was around. Bazak was off the boat as well, slated for transfer before the holddown from diesel boats to a billet in Admiral Rickover's nuclear navy. His orders didn't change. What did change, however, was Gudgeon's operating schedule. The Navy hastily announced that she was going to become the first submarine of any nation to circumnavigate the globe. It was the best way to get her out of the Pacific, where she was now well known to the Soviets, and it was the best way to try to keep the story from spreading throughout the sub-force. Of course, the Navy offered other explanations for the trip. Deeming it designed to implement a people-to-people program, President Eisenhower personally designated each man on the boat an ambassador of goodwill to the world. Each of these ambassadors was ordered never to talk about the incident. Meanwhile, energized by its victory, the Soviet Navy began roughing up other U.S. spy subs. Among them was the USS Wahoo, SS-565, which was caught near a Soviet beach early in 1958, but managed to escape even though one of her engines blew out. Perhaps because subs went about their work quietly, the Soviets showed more restraint than they did with spy planes, some of which deliberately lit up defense radars in order to measure those systems. As nasty as the underwater battles got, no subs were sunk, and the depth charges were usually no more powerful than the small explosives dropped on Gudgeon. But submarine battles in Soviet territory were now firmly entrenched as part of the Cold War, and tensions only intensified as both sides prepared to deploy their first missile subs. After the Soviets launched Sputnik in the fall of 1957, President Eisenhower quickly accelerated plans to build nuclear-powered subs that could fire Polaris ballistic missiles while hiding underwater. In the meantime, the Navy was refitting some diesel subs to carry Regulus-guided missiles, descendants of the German buzz bombs, with ranges of between 300 and 400 nautical miles. The Regulus subs would have to surface to launch, and the missiles would have to be guided by radar from launch to landing by both the sub and a second boat positioned closer to the Soviet coast. But they would still be a potent new threat to the Soviets. The fear that the Soviets would answer by sending their own spy subs and missile boats close to U.S. waters prodded top officials in Washington to extend their grasp over this business of underwater spying. Suddenly, operations that Navy fleet commanders had become used to controlling were being reviewed by the White House and the Pentagon. the CIA, and the National Security Agency, the code-breaking agency that was so super secretive that even people who worked there joked that NSA stood for No Such Agency, or Never Say Anything, also began to play a larger role in setting the priorities for what intelligence would be collected. Hardly any of the Soviet diesel subs had made the long transit to U.S. shores yet, but that didn't stop an outbreak of red hysteria. One member of the House of Representatives proclaimed that nearly 200 Soviet subs had been sighted off the Atlantic coast. Ordinary citizens began manning submarine watchtowers, and over the next several years, submarine sightings became more frequent. One woman, identified in Navy documents only as Mrs. Gilkinson, would report seeing three subs near a Florida beach, including one that she said came within 10 feet of her while she was skin diving. A man in Texas reported spotting a periscope in what turned out to be 5 feet of water. The Navy was watching for Soviet subs as well, but much of the surveillance was taking place just outside the natural bottleneck created by Greenland, Iceland, and the United Kingdom. It was an enormous advantage for the United States. Soviet ships and subs had to pass through this choke point, the Greenland-Iceland-UK, or GIUK gap, to take the Atlantic route to the United States. A string of U.S. diesel subs were often stationed on barrier ops outside the gap, and British naval forces also kept watch for Soviet subs. In addition, the U.S. Navy had begun seeding both the Atlantic and Pacific coasts with underwater listening devices, creating an underwater eavesdropping net known as SOSUS, for Sound Surveillance System, to detect ships and subs. Still, analysts trying to decipher the SOSUS recordings needed more data to be able to pick out the sounds of Soviet warships from all the background noise made by fishing trawlers and merchant ships. They needed a library of sound signatures, and that could best be created by sending spy subs to listen and record. There was one other thing the Navy was looking for, a chance for retribution. It wanted to get the Soviets back for Gudgeon and other acts of harassment against U.S. subs. Admiral Gerald Wright, Commander-in-Chief of the Atlantic Fleet, posted a framed proclamation outside his office. Whereas the presence of unidentified submarines in the approaches to the United States has been frequently reported, and whereas the submarines have been uncooperative in declaring either their identity or their intent, as is required by the customs and usages of honorable seamen, and whereas tangible evidence that these surreptitious operations are being conducted would result in appropriate embarrassment to those involved, therefore, I do hereby pledge to donate one case of Jack Daniel's Old Number 7 brand of quality Tennessee sour mash corn whiskey, made as our fathers made it for 7 generations at the oldest registered whiskey distillery in the United States, established 1866, to the first scene of action commander in the Atlantic who produces evidence that a non-U.S. or known friendly submarine has been worn out. Signed, Gerald Wright, Admiral, U.S. Navy. In May 1959, Wright declared a winner. The USS Grenadier, SS-525, chased a Soviet submarine near Iceland for 9 hours before forcing it to surface, completely worn out. Grenadier skipper Lieutenant Commander Theodore F. Davis got the whiskey, and the Navy had surfaced its first Soviet sub. More important, the Navy also had its first good look at a Soviet missile boat. Davis had trapped one of the Zulus that had been converted to carry missiles. He also brought home photographs and sound tapes, and the Navy quietly broadcast his success all over Washington. In fact, later that year, President Eisenhower's Special Assistant for Science and Technology, George B. Kistiakowsky, noted in his diary that he had received a very interesting account of the ways in which our Navy gets intimate information on the Soviet naval activities, a briefing that was so hush-hush he couldn't put it on paper. Someday, he mused, it will make a very exciting news story. Something else came out of these dogfights as well. There was a growing realization on both sides that as much as the snorkel had revolutionized submarine warfare, it had massive limitations. As long as submarines could be held down and their crews choked, they were still too vulnerable. For the U.S. subforce, it was clear that Rickover's nuclear navy could no longer remain a curiosity. It was time for his submarines to move to center stage. Rickover's revolutionary boats had a seemingly endless source of power. Reactors split atoms and turned water into steam. Steam enough to power a propeller shaft and run a submarine longer and faster than any diesel boat ever could. They also could generate their own oxygen and scrub excess carbon dioxide from their air. Hold downs would no longer be a threat. These boats would be able to stay underwater indefinitely. Nuclear attack subs began to take on missions that closely mirrored those pioneered by diesel subs, invading Soviet waters with impunity. The orders remained similar. Drive close to Soviet craft, even closer to Soviet shores. Take any risks. Don't get caught. For instance, in late 1960, Commander William Bill Behrens drove the USS Skipjack, SSN 585, into the mouth of the long ship channel that led to Murmansk. He got so close to another Soviet port that his officers could look through a periscope and see the pier only 30 or 40 yards away. That may have been closer than even the Navy would have liked, at least closer than the Navy ever wanted to admit. Indeed, just before Barron snuck into the channel, crewmen saw one of his officers disable a mechanical tracing device that plotted the sub's movements so there would never be any written record of the incursion. Later on that same mission, Barron also monitored the sea trials of one of the first Gulf-class subs, a diesel-powered boat that was the first Soviet submarine designed from the start to carry ballistic missiles. Behrens, who initially struck some of his crew as stuffy and dull, had proven that he could play as dangerously as other captains, that he could be one man on shore and quite another at sea, especially at sea in Soviet waters. In this sense, Behrens was not alone. This was an era of daredevil nuclear sub-captains who seemed rooted in the no-holds-barred diesel heritage. Over in the Pacific, a couple of captains briefly turned off their reactors to cut down on the background noise when they tried to get sound signatures, and suddenly found their own boats drifting way too deep. Another sub lurking at periscope depth got bumped by a Soviet sub that started to surface from below. One of the most urgent goals was to find out where the Soviets stood in their quest to develop nuclear-powered subs. Though some top U.S. officials were reluctant to believe it, it gradually became clear that the Soviets were starting to turn out three types. Hotels, each armed with three ballistic missiles. Echoes, carrying cruise missiles meant for use against ships. And November attack subs. Still, early surveillance showed that these subs were so crude and noisy that the U.S. Navy had taken to using a shorthand built on a convenient acronym, nicknaming them the Hens. And neither the Gulfs nor the hotels were anywhere near ready to head out on patrol. It was clear that the United States had won the race to position missile subs within range of enemy shores. Four diesel boats with the primitive Regulus missiles had led the way in the Pacific in 1959 and 1960, and the first Polaris sub, the USS George Washington, SSBN 598, ventured out into the Atlantic, underway on nuclear power, in November 1960. In no time, the Regulus subs were spending so much time lurking in terrible weather off the Soviet coast that their crews took to jokingly calling themselves the Northern Pacific Yacht Club. One, the USS Growler, SSG 577, was heavily damaged when it ran into an ice floe near the Kamchatka Peninsula, just off the Soviet base at Petropavlovsk. Before long, the men designed lapel pins showing an anchor crossed by three semaphore flags, labeled S, M, and F. The initials stood for the typical cry during a storm. Shit! Man! Fuck! Throughout these deployments, the Polaris program was pushing on. President Eisenhower had given William F. Red Rayburn, the garrulous rear admiral in charge of Polaris, unprecedented authority, allowing him to bypass the usual red tape and to hire anyone he decided could do the work of designing and building Polaris subs well and fast. There were predictable snags with the new technology. Rayburn's aides showed enough humor to compile a classified film of Polaris bloopers, test missiles that barely rose at all, and others that just cartwheeled. But Polaris succeeded, and timetables were met, largely because the program was given top priority. Everyone was working such ungodly hours that the submariners came to believe that the new boats were designated SSBNs, not because SS stood for submersible ship, N for nuclear power, and B for ballistic missiles, but because the initials stood for Saturday, Sunday, and a bunch of nights. While Rayburn and his team labored to ensure that the subs were built, it was up to Rickover to oversee the installation of the nuclear reactors and the crews that would run them. Rickover was looking for men who would be unflinching in a crisis, men willing to pay attention to exact detail, men who were as meticulous as he was. He was convinced that was the only way to ensure reactor safety, and he knew that reactor safety was the only way to maintain public support for his nuclear-powered submarines. With all of this, he was helping to create a submarine force that would be unparalleled. Now Rickover's men were about to drive the most lethal subs ever built, subs that would prove crucial to the balance of power in the Cold War. The first Polaris subs were 382 feet long, about 60 feet longer than nuclear attack subs, and they carried 16 nuclear-tipped missiles that could be aimed at targets more than 1,000 nautical miles away. They were also given two crews, Blue and Gold, who went out on alternating 60-day cruises, keeping the subs at sea as much as possible. The duty was tough. The 1,000-mile missile range forced these boats to ride the rough waters off the northern coast of Europe to stay near targeting distance of Moscow. Their job was to hide with pride, to be an intercontinental missile force lurking and ready to fire a second strike if the nation were attacked and land missiles destroyed. Although not even the president knew where the Polaris missile subs patrolled at any given time, they did have prescribed operating areas to run through. Boxes made up of hundreds of miles of ocean that kept these first missile subs close to the 1,000-mile launch range of their targets. There were also crucial safeguards to make it impossible for one madman, acting on his own, to start a nuclear war. First, any launch order had to match exactly the authenticator codes that varied by date and were kept on board the sub behind two sets of locked doors in a safe welded to a bulkhead in the control room. Two men held the combinations to open the safe and check the authenticator codes, which they showed to the CO and the XO. Once the order to launch had been verified, three men had to use separate keys, also kept in safes, to actually launch a missile. The CO's key allowed him to activate the ship's fire control system. The XO's key armed the missile release mechanisms. Then the mission control officer could use his key to fire the missiles. The process was supposed to take about 15 minutes. For their part, the Soviets had only a few nuclear-powered subs, and those so ill-designed that men were dying. One submarine suffered such a horrible reactor accident that it was redubbed the Hiroshima by survivors. By the time the Soviets tried to locate missile launchers in Cuba in 1962, the United States had moved so far ahead that it was able to quickly scramble several Polaris submarines, ultimately nine in all, to points within shooting distance of the Soviet Union. The U.S. public never knew just how afraid its government had become that the Soviets would escalate any naval confrontation. Just months earlier, a Soviet defector had presented what had become known as the Ironbark Papers, details of Soviet plans to use tactical nuclear weapons against U.S. ships and subs if a war broke out at sea. President John F. Kennedy's advisors were haunted by the thought that the Soviet Union could have engineered the first crude steps of that plan. Indeed, Kennedy was afraid that any battle at sea might intensify the crisis, with or without nuclear weapons being fired. As he instituted the U.S. naval blockade of Cuba, a Soviet sub was spotted near two Soviet freighters. When Kennedy heard that, he asked his aides, "Isn't there some way we can avoid having our first exchange with a Russian submarine?" "Almost anything but that." There were such exchanges, but none lived up to Kennedy's worst fears. U.S. surface ships and aircraft near Cuba spotted a handful of Soviet diesel subs and easily surfaced three of them. The United States had a clear advantage. But for how long? The crisis might have taught Soviet leaders that it would be impossible to build a nuclear missile force on land near U.S. shores. But by scrambling the Polaris subs into firing position, the United States had also shown the Soviets a better way to accomplish the same thing. Chapter 3. Turn to the Deep. Flying on the wild success of his Polaris program, Admiral Red Rayburn began looking ahead, thinking about new, imaginative ways of furthering nuclear deterrence. He quickly turned to the dreamer within his ranks, a young civilian whom the Admiral had plucked from obscurity a few years earlier and anointed the chief scientist for Polaris. John P. Craven was only in his mid-30s when Rayburn found him, but it was his job to look over the shoulder of everyone involved in the development of the missile subs, to find the problems, to come up with the answers. He was, as he put it, Chief Kibitzer. The moniker fit. Talking a torrent, his ideas usually overflowing, Craven was the kind of man who could dissect a blueprint and still have time to spout a few lines of poetry, biblical verse, or one of his endless series of self-scripted maxims of the sea. Sometimes he'd mix verse with maxim and sing the result aloud. He preached fantasy amid military discipline. He carried romance to the mechanics of nuclear war. It was a role Craven had been bred to. He was the product of a family that reached back to Moorish pirates on his mother's side, and was divided on his father's between Presbyterian ministers and Navy officers, yawning in the family pew. The Navy brass was the part of the lineage that most of the Cravens liked to boast about, the part that went back to Tunis Augustus McDonough Craven, who skippered the Civil War Union ship Tecumseh, and drowned at the helm when she was rammed by a Confederate mine during the Battle of Mobile Bay, and inspired Admiral David Farragut's memorable cry to the remaining fleet, "Damn the torpedoes! Full speed ahead!" But only John Craven boasted of what the rest of his family dared not even whisper, the pirate blood he inherited from his mother's side. That John Craven was going to be different was evident from the moment he made his first appearance on the planet, landing in the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn. It was a Halloween night, a fact that his paternal relatives chose to ignore, as they instantly christened him Navy, fully intending that he would live a life of rigid military discipline. That their plan was doomed to fail became clear some 15 years later, when Craven was rejected by the Naval Academy. It wasn't for lack of intelligence. He'd skipped through to high school by the time he was 11 years old. But once there, he took the rogue's route to popularity. He convinced his much older classmates that he was merely small for his age, and then proceeded to win their respect by becoming the class wise guy, the kid who was too tough to do homework. Ultimately, he fulfilled at least part of his family's expectations. He never earned a Naval Academy degree, but he did get his commission in the reserves and became an ocean engineer. From then on, he took to sermonizing about the deep, about underwater maneuvers that most of the Navy passed off as impossible, or at least hugely improbable. He expected no easy converts. But like any minister preaching the coming of a miracle, Craven was drenched in the faith that he would ultimately be proven right. Now, Rayburn was handing Craven a nearly blank check to do what he did best, come up with ideas, as many as he could. By 1963, Craven was working hard on Rayburn's vision of an advanced sea-based deterrent program. As his first step, he set aside $1 million a year, thinking that would be just enough to create a small political science program to dissect the strategy of deterrence. In the process, he discovered he had hired just about every political scientist specializing in strategic defense. With the rest of his budget and his new platform, he began to peer into an untouched realm of the deep, working with his group to scribble out ideas. Missiles that could be placed miles below the surface on the ocean floor. Submarines that could reach down and see through the murky depths, carry cameras into untraveled and alien waters. Most of the Navy greeted Craven's visions with hardly a yawn. What little study of the deep there had been before had long ago been shoved into a corner, the purview of a small group of oceanographers. Admirals saw operating in deep water as more difficult than the manned outer space launches that, at that moment, held the nation's attention hostage. The Navy's best submarines could reach down just 1,000 to 1,500 feet or so. Go deeper, and there was certain death by implosion from punishing sea pressures great enough to quickly crush even the mighty Polaris subs. The miles below the Navy's operational slice garnered about as much respect as the average landfill. The Navy's main design branch, the Bureau of Ships, listed deep submergence as 10th on its list of top 10 priorities, giving the deep number 10 only because the list wasn't any longer. Even Admiral Rickover, wrapped as he was in the public mantle of Navy innovator, was uninterested in plumbing the depths. Craven's Deep Submergence Group was on the fringe, but eager to work. A team of his scientists was asked to help test the USS Thresher, SSN 593, the first of a powerful new class of nuclear attack submarines designed to go somewhat deeper than the other subs of the day. On April 10, 1963, Thresher failed during a test dive to 1,300 feet. As best as anyone could tell, a piping failure and a subsequent loss of propulsion set off a series of events that caused the submarine to sink, killing all 129 men aboard, including four men from Craven's team. Craven got the news as he was sitting with Harry Jackson, an engineering officer who had helped test the sub shortly before her last dive, and who had been present for every other deep dive. Jackson sat, repeating over and over, "I should have been there." But Craven was relieved that Jackson had missed this, the nation's first loss of a nuclear submarine, along with three of Craven's own men, who had been scratched from the test for lack of space. It was only later that Craven realized that the disaster was about to mark him among the most important players in a new and dramatic chapter in this saga of undersea spying. Craven's opportunity would spring from the almost impossible promises the Navy made in its efforts at damage control. In the wake of Thresher, the Navy promised a massive effort to learn about the unforgiving ocean depths. There would be a sub-safe program. There would be deep submergence rescue vehicles. This was the Navy's chance to calm the public, a chance to erase tragedy with visions of ocean wonder, a chance to obscure submarine dangers beneath visions of safety innovations. Almost everyone involved recognized that some of the proposals were more science fiction than science, especially the prospect of deep submergence rescue vehicles, DSRVs, for sunken subs. Anyone who was to be rescued would have to have the good fortune to go down over a continental shelf, or atop an undersea mountain, in waters far more shallow than the 2 or 3 or 4 miles of depth that made up much of the world's oceans. Most submariners knew that a severe casualty at sea almost always meant that they would disappear. No survivors, no rescue, nothing more to say. Still, Congress okayed these popular proposals and offered up funding that caught the attention of the Office of Naval Intelligence. The Navy might have been promising an era that mirrored Jules Verne, but a few submarine espionage specialists now saw the means to launch a new age of spying that would be much closer to James Bond. These intelligence officers were already crafting their plans when Craven began directing a massive post-Thresher study. He had also taken charge of the Deep Submergence Systems Project, a program created to design the Navy's promised deep submergence rescue vehicles and to build an underwater laboratory, a habitat known as Sea Lab, where the Navy could study the physiological effects of deep-sea pressures on divers. Craven saw opportunity, especially in the DSRV program. Like nearly everyone else with knowledge of the oceans, he knew that the DSRVs were largely fantasy. But he reasoned that maybe the push to build them might give him an edge in pursuing another of his dreams, a fleet of mini-submarines made of glass. Chemically, glass is a liquid, so Craven reasoned that glass submarines would be at their strongest under the most powerful deep ocean pressures. He wasn't the only one trying to sell the Navy on the idea of some kind of mini-submarine. Reynolds Aluminum Company was building its own boat, hoping to gain a lucrative contract. The Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, with the Office of Naval Research, was designing the Alvin, a 3-man submersible that could go down 6,000 feet. At this point, The only deep submersible the Navy had in-house was the Trieste II, a mini dirigible that had to be carried or towed to dive sites. It had only limited maneuverability, but it could bring a crew of three down to 20,000 feet. The first Trieste had been lowered nearly 7 miles in 1960 to the deepest spot in the world, the Challenger Deep in the Marianas Trench, about 200 miles from Guam. Both Trieste 1 and 2 explored Thresher's wreckage. It was just as Craven began to work out the mechanics of self-propelled, independent, deep-sea mini-subs that he was approached by a naval intelligence officer, one of the men who helped coordinate the submarine surveillance operations off the Soviet coasts. By now, those operations had been expanded to provide a year-round presence. Operating under the code name Binnacle, later Holy Stone, the Navy's growing fleet of nuclear subs and diesels were keeping constant watch on the Soviets as they aimed test launches of missiles from land silos and ships into the oceans. U.S. subs were also tracking the rapidly expanding fleet of Soviet nuclear subs as they finally began to venture out into the Atlantic and the Pacific. The Soviet Navy was beginning to enact its long-threatened plan to become a blue water force. With all this going on, the U.S. Navy nearly always had at least one surveillance sub in the Barents and two off the Soviet Pacific ports, where they still had to dodge occasional Soviet depth charges. Even some of the early nuclear subs, like the USS Scamp, SSN 588, got chased with small depth charges, and more diesel subs, such as the USS Ronquil, SS 396, and the USS Trumpetfish, SS 425, got held down gudgeon style in the early 1960s. In addition to these operations off the Soviet coast, some diesel subs carried Russian émigrés back to the Soviet Union to spy for the United States, and other diesel subs were landing commandos in places like Borneo, Indonesia, and the Middle East to track the expanding Soviet influence. Shortly after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, Navy commandos used diesel submarines to engineer the escape of prominent Cubans from Castro's regime. Over several weeks, commandos slipped from the subs and rowed to shore in inflatable rafts. The Cubans, who were piloted back to the subs, often had to dive 15 to 30 feet through dark waters to enter the submerged craft through special pressurized compartments. Many of those rescued likely would have been jailed or executed for plotting to overthrow Castro, according to former U.S. sailors involved in the operation. Submarine spying had become so important that the Chief of Naval Operations in Washington had taken charge of coordinating all operations, and a special undersea warfare office had been set up within the Office of Naval Intelligence to plan them. Intelligence officials were so anxious to learn the latest about new Soviet subs and missiles that submarine spooks were under orders to flash off messages with mission highlights on the transit home. The Russian language experts among them began transcribing tapes of stolen communications as soon as they left Soviet waters. Couriers met returning submarines at the dock, ready to whisk the intelligence directly to NSA headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland. The spooks themselves were so valuable that the Navy ordered them to travel to and from ports by train rather than on commercial plane. The Navy wasn't willing to risk even a slim chance that they might be hijacked to Cuba. Now the naval intelligence officer had come to Craven, asking him to help with a grander effort than any that had been tried before. The officer handed Craven a top-secret document, actually a very long wish list that naval intelligence had been amassing for several years, a document that had been touched by barely a dozen people before him. Stamped across the front page were the words, Operation Sand Dollar. From there, the list went on for pages. These were the splashdown points for Soviet ballistic missiles, painstakingly monitored and noted by Navy surface ships and Air Force radar and underwater hydrophones, as well as the locations of planes and other Soviet military hardware glimpsed or heard plunging through the waves. Only a few miles away, three at most, lay the Soviets' most sensitive defense secrets. The best in Soviet missile guidance systems, metallurgy, and electronics. All of it tantalizing trash, and all of it out of reach. No wonder the Soviet Union didn't even try to guard the cache. Nobody could have imagined an undersea raid through stars of luminescent plankton to the utter blackness of the deep. But why not, intelligence officers reasoned, use the comforting notion of deep submergence rescue vehicles to mask an effort to reach the items cataloged in Sand Dollar? Why not use the budgets of rescue gadgets that would hardly ever be used to create some tools that might just give the United States the definitive edge? The Thresher tragedy would be the excuse, the new safety programs the stuff of a complicated cover story. And all of it was dependent on Craven's answer to one question. Could he manage a deep water treasure hunt? It was a matter of top national security, Craven was told. Left unsaid was that it was also a matter of pride, political standing, and turf. The intelligence arm of the Navy was in a desperate game of catch-up with that of the Air Force, which had just launched a new generation of spy satellites. With their growing coverage of the Soviet Union, these new eyes in the sky were sending back images of sites where the Soviets were digging silos for powerful land-based missiles and dry docks where the Soviets were preparing to create their own generation of Polaris-like submarines. The Polaris program had managed to prevent Air Force bombers and rockets from monopolizing the business of nuclear deterrence. Now, maybe Navy spies could compete with the satellites, diving not for mere pictures, but for actual Soviet arms and craft. This was the opportunity Craven had been looking for, a chance to tap into his most fantastic plans. There was only one thing stopping him. He had no idea how to accomplish what the intelligence officer was asking for. Even Trieste II couldn't manage much of a secret undersea raid. It was too small, and the surface ship needed to carry the submersible out to mid-ocean would be a dead giveaway. "Basically, we are developing the technology, but not the assets," Craven said, calling upon his best Navy speak. Silence. Two beats, maybe three. No matter how officiously he said it, he was still admitting he had no way to do what he was being asked. Then Craven had a flash of inspiration. "Hey, look, we don't have anything that could do your operation because that requires things be clandestine." One more quick inhale, and he came out with the kicker. "So it's really not worth doing, Sand Dollar, unless you do it from a submarine." There it was, blurted out in desperation, the idea for what would become the Navy's most daring venture yet. A full-sized submarine, big enough to navigate the high seas, would be outfitted to hover in place in the upper reaches of the ocean and dangle cameras miles down, deep enough to scout the ocean bottom for Soviet treasures. It was inspired. Make the effort from below the surface. Find a way to be nearly undetectable. Never let the Soviets know the Americans were anywhere near. Actually, all Craven was doing was rehashing his long-held belief that operating from the ocean surface was its own kind of hell. He had already included the concept in his self-scripted Ten Commandments of Deep Ocean Engineering. The way he said it was, "Remember that the free surface is neither ocean nor air, and that man cannot walk upon it, nor will equipments remain stable in its presence. So design your equipments that they tarry not long, and that they need neither servicing nor repair at this unseemly interface." Now, suddenly, he had not only the means to put that commandment to the test, he also had his chance to fulfill his favorite part of his lineage, and plunder buried treasure. His pulpit secure, his corsair's blood aboil, all Craven needed was a submarine. There were 20 nuclear attack subs in the fleet now, and more being built. But Navy admirals weren't about to give up a first-rate boat so that it could sit out in mid-ocean, trolling with cameras. If Craven wanted a sub, he would have to take one of the Navy's 2 nuclear clunkers, the 2 failed experiments whose designs were never replicated. There was the USS Seawolf, a confused boat, with a bow, V-shaped like a destroyer, and the top of the sub built to house a touchy reactor run with liquid sodium, a reactor that had been replaced early on. Then there was the USS Halibut, a boat with a grander but short-lived past. Halibut, SSGN 587, had been the only nuclear sub to carry the Regulus guided missiles, making 7 missions off the Soviet coast. But that program had ended in mid-1964, when the Navy began basing Polaris subs in the Pacific. With the Regulus era over, no one quite knew what to do with Halibut. She was a marine oddball, one of the least hydrodynamic of the nuclear fleet, and one of the most ridiculous-looking creations ever born in a dry dock. Unlike the flat fish she was named for, Halibut wore a huge hump that might have been appropriate on a gargantuan desert creature, except for the fact that it opened up into a large shark's mouth hatch, part of the original missile hangar. Perhaps at another time, Halibut would have been quietly scrapped. After all, this boat was not only odd, she suffered from what was a near-fatal malady for a submarine— hydromechanical cacophony. Halibut was loud. Submariners heard the din, saw only potential flooding when they gazed upon that hatch, and shuddered when they examined her cumbersome ballast tanks, gaping caverns originally designed to allow her to surface fast, shoot a missile, and submerge even faster. Craven took one look at the submarine it seemed nobody could love, and was transfixed. All he saw were the possibilities, the strange and wonderful things that could be done with all of that excess space. And when he caught a glimpse of that gorgeous gaping mouth, it was enough to send him, like any self-respecting mad scientist, reeling with joy. No other submarine in the fleet boasted a hatch larger than 26 inches. Halibut's hatch was 22 feet. It was settled. Halibut would be Craven's submarine, his laboratory, his ministry, his pirate ship. He would have $70 million to outfit her with electronic, sonic, photographic, and video gadgets. The Navy put out the word, and in February 1965, Halibut went into Pearl Harbor to be refitted as an oceanographic research vessel. Less a lie than a huge omission, that was only one of several cover stories Craven would employ. The DSRV program and his other deep-sea projects would add more layers, all hiding what Craven had proclaimed to be his skunk works, a term he borrowed for its drama from Lockheed Aircraft Corporation, the spy plane manufacturer Craven would soon have working on the design of the DSRVs and also on a deep submergence search vehicle. The plan was that the DSSV would be able to sit on the ocean floor 20,000 feet deep and pick up objects with a mechanical arm, It was to travel to any recovery area mounted on the top of a submarine. It would take 2 years to rebuild and test Halibut, but Craven would have little time to be impatient. From almost the moment the refit began, Craven's mass of cover stories began earning him notice outside the insular realm of naval intelligence. Suddenly, he was being pulled into other high-profile projects. Rickover, who had once done everything he could to limit Craven's interest in deep-diving mini-subs, now came to Craven, asking him to help build the first nuclear-powered one, though one of steel, not glass. The Admiral would forever remain scathing about glass, to the point of insult. But Craven was now working with Rickover, and the liaison would prove to be a crucial step in the scientist's education. Crucial because it was through Rickover that Craven would learn how to mine the Navy's budget, deal with Congress, and handle the cadre of admirals who ran the submarine program. It was a Faustian pact. Rickover may have been 64 years old, an age at which even less controversial officers have long been retired. But Craven, just like about everyone else in the Navy, could never quite learn to handle him. Rickover liked to begin their conversations in a way that showed just who was in charge.
"Craven, my people are more competent than your people, but your shop is bigger, so I'm going to have to work with you."
Rickover liked to try to throw men off balance, just to see how they would handle themselves. Rickover personally christened the mini-sub NR-1. It might as well have been called the USS Rickover, for NR was the designation for the Naval Reactors Branch, Rickover's realm. If the President could have Air Force One, Rickover would have his NR-1. Unlike Woods Hole's Alvin, which was completed in 1965 and was only 22 feet long, NR-1 was to be 137 feet, nearly half the size of an attack sub. NR-1 would be able to go down to 3,000 feet, equipped with underwater lights, cameras, and a grappling arm to retrieve small objects. It also would have the potential to do some spying. One of the chief design problems was finding some way to shield the nuclear reactor in the NR-1. Standard sub-reactors were shielded with a foot of lead on either end, but that would have made the NR-1 too heavy. Instead, Rickover, Craven, and the other designers decided it would have the standard lead shielding only in front, where it faced crew compartments. The entire 13-foot area of the sub behind the reactor would be closed off permanently and flooded. The idea was to allow the wall of water to absorb any escaping radiation and work as a substitute for lead shielding. Craven had no doubt that environmentalists would cringe at the plan, but both he and Rickover believed it was entirely workable. 13 feet of water has the same molecular weight as 1 foot of lead. But when NR-1 was submerged, the water would add no weight at all. When water displaces an equal amount of water, the effective weight is zero. But before NR-1 could be built, it had to be paid for. And right now there was little room in the budget for a mini-submarine among the plans for DSRVs and Sea Labs. The problem didn't faze Rickover, and he solved it at a meeting with Craven. Rear Admiral Levering Smith, Rayborn's top deputy on Polaris, and Robert Morse, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Research and Development.
"Do you have any money we can get started with right now?" Rickover asked.
Craven answered that his deep submergence group could spare $10 million of its research and development money. Smith noted that the Polaris program had about $10 million of unused ship construction funds.
"How much is this submarine going to cost?" Morse asked.
Without hesitation, Rickover answered, $20 million. Morse went on to outline the torturous process by which ships are normally built: contract definition, bidding, congressional approvals.
Rickover cut him off before he could finish. "Just leave all that to me." Then Rickover turned to Craven and directed, "You call up Electric Boat tomorrow and tell them to get started." Craven, Smith, and Morse exchanged looks of disbelief. Nobody believed this could be done for $20 million. The budget soon grew to $30 million. They also saw no way that Congress was going to stand for this. Less than a week later, Rickover called Craven and told him that the president was going to announce that afternoon that NR-1 was going to be built. Upon hearing the news, Morse moved quickly from a state of shock into a state of panic. Up until that moment, NR-1 had been little more than an admiral's fantasy. Indeed, Rickover had given only sketchy accounts of his plan to Paul H. Nitze, the Secretary of the Navy, and Robert S. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense. Though both had approved it, Morse knew Congress was not going to like hearing about a major project this way. As soon as the president announced the NR-1, the House Committee on Appropriations hastily called a hearing. Craven, on Rickover's orders, had just a few days to come up with an official mission statement, a full-bore cost-benefit analysis, and a detailed study as to why the Navy needed the mini-sub. "Well, you know, Admiral, that study really doesn't exist," Craven answered. "It will exist by the time the hearing takes place," Rickover barked back. Now the existence of NR-1, and perhaps his own career, rested on Craven's ability to spin visions from a black hole. He needed to prove that NR-1 was a crucial investment, one worth $30 million. The Appropriations Committee wasn't fooled, but in the end it had no choice but to give in. NR-1 was now a presidential directive. No other submarine or ship had ever been authorized faster, or ever would be again. Later, the General Accounting Office, Congress's investigative arm, scrutinized the project and concluded that it was one of the worst-managed programs its investigators had ever seen. Rickover answered in typical form, firing off a letter to his critics that so amazed Craven that he committed it to memory. "I read the GAO report, and it reminds me of a review I read of Lady Chatterley's Lover in the magazine Field and Stream. The reviewer of that book knew as much about the real purpose of Lady Chatterley's Lover as the GAO knows about the design and development of submarines." Rickover was no gentler on Craven. The Admiral was infuriated that he had to share Craven with the Halibut refit, the DSRV program, and the other deep ocean projects. As far as Rickover was concerned, none of those was more important than his NR-1. Making the Admiral even angrier was the fact that he was not cleared for the details about Halibut's new mission. Little went on within the submarine force that he didn't know something about, but the intelligence programs were one of the few areas in which he had no official in, no real say. He took out his frustrations on Craven, who began to imagine that the Admiral was waiting up nights before calling, waiting until Craven fell into a deep slumber or thought about romancing his wife. He was almost convinced that his time submerged conducting tests on Halibut was being monitored by Rickover, who seemed to time his calls for moments when it was impossible for Craven to answer. Craven always paid dearly for being unavailable. One Friday, Rickover was giving a speech in New York City, and he sent word to Halibut, which was out near Hawaii, demanding that Craven meet him in New York first thing Monday morning. Craven hopped a plane, suffered a moment of panic when the flight got socked in by fog during a layover in Los Angeles, and finally landed in New York and raced, breathless, to Rickover's hotel suite, where the Admiral was waiting. "You were out there playing golf with the Beach Boys," he said, mocking the cover story Craven had crafted for his trip to Hawaii. He then turned to the house phone. "Bring this man the biggest lunch in the hotel." Craven waited for the punchline. He knew the Admiral wasn't worried that he might be hungry after the long trip. Sure enough. For the next hour, you are going to sit and eat lunch, Rickover announced. And I am going to bawl you out. Appearances to the contrary, Rickover liked Craven almost as much as he liked making him miserable. Rickover was impressed that Craven had moxie enough to withstand his worst tantrums. The Admiral also loved that Craven had never attended the Naval Academy. Rickover had been a loner as a midshipman, and now he made great sport of adding a little torture to the mix when he interviewed Naval Academy graduates for his nuclear program. Those entrance interviews had become more like initiation rites, in which the Admiral took young men to the psychological brink in his quest for perfection. Trying to rattle his applicants, Rickover would spout obscenities, seat them in chairs with one leg cut short, or send them off to Siberia, a storage closet, where they would be left for hours. Perhaps the all-time Rickover classic occurred when he squared off against a candidate and said, "Piss me off if you can." The young man answered without hesitation and without a word. He lifted his arm and with one motion swept Rickover's desk clean of books, papers, pens, everything. The candidate was accepted. For Rickover, torturing Craven was a mere sideline. Craven, meanwhile, was increasingly on call as the Navy's resident deep-ocean expert. But there was one call that stood out from all the rest. It came on a Saturday morning in January 1966. "This is Jack Howard," said an Assistant Secretary of Defense in charge of nuclear matters. "I've lost an H-bomb." "Why are you calling me?" Craven asked. "This one I've lost in the water, and I want you to find it." Craven was being assigned to work with a team hastily assembled by an admiral in the Pentagon. Another group was going to the site. A B-52 bomber had collided with an air tanker during a refueling operation 30,000 feet in the air off the coast of Palomares, Spain, losing its atomic payload. Three of four bombs were recovered almost immediately, but a fourth was lost and had presumably fallen to the bottom of the Mediterranean. President Lyndon Johnson knew the Soviets were looking for the bomb, and he refused to believe the Navy's assurances that there was a good probability that it would never be recovered by either side. Indeed, that was the belief of most of the people assigned to find the bomb. But not Craven. Craven called in a group of mathematicians and sent them to work constructing a map of the sea bottom outside Palomares. That sounded reasonable enough, but Craven intended to use that map for an analysis that seemed more reminiscent of racetrack betting than of anything ever put down in a Navy search and salvage manual. Once the map was completed, Craven asked a group of submarine and salvage experts to place Las Vegas-style bets on the probability of each of the different scenarios that might describe the bomb's loss being considered by the search team in Spain. Each scenario left the weapon in a different location. Then each possible location was run through a formula that was based on the odds created by the betting round. The locations were then replotted, yards or miles away from where logic and acoustic science alone would place them. To the uninitiated, all this sounded like the old joke about a man who loses his wallet in a dark alley. Instead of searching the alley, the man chooses to search for his wallet yards away under a street lamp, because the light there is better. But as far as Craven was concerned, there was good science behind his apparent madness. He was relying on Bayes' theorem of subjective probability, an algebraic formula crafted by Thomas Bayes, a mathematician born in 1760. Essentially, the theorem was supposed to quantify the value of the hunch, factor in the knowledge that exists in people beyond their conscious minds. Craven applied that doctrine to the search. The bomb had been hitched to two parachutes. He took bets on whether both had opened, or one, or none. He went through the same exercise over each possible detail of the crash. His team of mathematicians wrote out possible endings to the crash story and took bets on which ending they believed most. After the betting rounds were over, they used the odds they created to assign probability quotients to several possible locations. Then they mapped those probabilities and came up with the most probable site and several other possible ones. Without ever having gone to sea, the team now believed they knew where the bomb was. According to their calculations, the most probable site lay far from where the other three bombs had been recovered, and far from where most of the plane's debris had hit the water. Worse, if Craven's calculations were correct, the bomb lay in a deep ravine and was all but unreachable. The Navy had come across a Spaniard who was reputed to be the very best fisherman in Palomares, Francisco Simo Orts. Simo Orts claimed to have seen the bomb fall into the water, and he pinpointed its location right over the same ravine. With no other leads, the team in the Med had no choice but to arrange a serious search of the ravine, and began contacting the companies that had tried to interest the Navy in their deep-diving submersibles. The Bureau of Ships agreed to pay to fly two submersibles to Palomares, Reynolds Illuminati and Woods Hole's Alvin. After several weeks and no success, President Johnson was furious. He demanded to know where the bomb was, and he demanded to know just when it would be recovered. In answer, a copy of Craven's latest probability hill, altered to take the weeks of failures into account, was sent to the president. Johnson blew up at the sight of Craven's curves and graphs. If the search teams couldn't give him instant answers, the president would find scientists who could. He insisted that another group of scientists be hired from Cornell and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They met in an all-day session. In the end, they agreed that Craven's plan was the best anyone had. Johnson didn't have much time to react, for that same day, the crew of the Alvin, on its 10th day,